the Kolyma Gulag, the coldest prison on Earth. The Soviet Union, 1937. Under the iron rule of dictator Joseph Stalin, all who were undesirable in Soviet society, suspected spies, murderers, thieves, political dissenters, are quickly dispatched to the infamous gulags, a series of savage labor camps hidden within the icy depths of the Siberian hinterland. But even in this frozen hell on earth, cruelty is relative. And for those imprisoned in the gulags, no place was worse than the remote penal colonies of Kolyma. With frigid sub-zero temperatures, the Kolyma gulags are in reality glacial graveyards. But Kolyma is also the site of Russia's richest gold deposits. So not only were the Soviets able to punish people here, they reaped enormous riches from the forced labor. During the winter, temperatures drop to a merciless 90 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. The combination of back-breaking mining and unrelenting subthermal temperatures results in an astronomical mortality rate. From the late 30s to the early 50s, nearly 35% of all prisoners would die each year at Kolyma. Ironically, it would be a case of spinal tuberculosis that would keep prisoner George Bean out of the deadly mines, saving his life.
When I talked to other people who survived similarly like I did, I became convinced that only those survived who, for any reason at all, did not have to work in the mines. Those who worked in the mines, that was practically death sentence.
If assignment to the gold mines was a death sentence, malnutrition made the penalty swift and sure.
The food ration was absolutely minimal. In the morning, as a rule, they gave you tea and about 10 grams of sugar. It was enough for sustaining yourself, but not for work. And that was a problem. All those who worked, they died from hunger.
At its peak, prisoners of the Kolyma camps mined between 400 and 500 tons of gold a year. But the cost of this gold was nearly 3 million deaths in less than 20 years. After Stalin's death in 1953, the use of forced labor was reduced in the gulags, but it would not be totally eliminated until Gorbachev came to power. But the horrific history of these Arctic death camps will forever be frozen in the memory of the survivors of Kolyma, the coldest prison system on Earth.
Stones in the north resisted with all their might to prevent the dead from entering their bowels. The stones promised to forget nothing, promised to wait and keep the secret. Severe winters, hot summers, and brutal rains took the dead men from the stone. The earth opened up, revealing its underground stores, because not only gold, not only tin, not only wolfram, not only uranium are in the Kolyma underground stores, but also human bodies, untouched by decay. On the 4th of February, 1932, all the administration of the Dolstoy and the first volunteers who responded to the call of the motherland to conquer severe and impregnable Kolyma arrived in the Bay of Nagayeva.
I was really imbued with Jack London stories, and in those brutal times, in 31, when neither in the provinces nor in city was there any place for romantics or beauty, you couldn't come to terms with yourself. It was quite natural that I longed for some far-off and more interesting places. So it happened, I managed to get to Kolyma. I was 20 at the time.
Trenin Lev Mikhailovich, born in 1911, lives in Kolyma since 1932. Topographer, civilian.
Well, there had already been a prisoners' camp there, but we did not notice it.
Long before the arrival of the commanding administrators of the Dolstoy, Berzin dispatched more than 200,000 of its prisoners to Magadan, only a quarter of which survived. It was they who began to build the town of Magadan and the first Kalama camps.
The first transports of prisoners were those convicted according to Article 7832. That was of August 7th, 1932. It was a time of starvation when people took grains left in the fields after harvesting or cabbages at night. All the same, they were convicted by the Troika, court of three judges, with no defense, and as a rule, their fate was 10-year sentence and no discussion allowed.
Berzin Eduard Petrovich, born 1884, the first director of the Dolstoy, 1931 to 1937, shot in 1938.
There were many stories told about him, both good and bad. For instance, there was this notorious dipper from the drag that had sunk, and we had to build a framework to go into the icy water and get it. People were dying like flies, but it was unthinkable to leave the dipper there. Well, they reported to Berzin in Magadan. People are dying. What's to be done? He reasoned this way. What's the cost of the dipper? 15,000 gold rubles. What's the cost of a prisoner? 2.5 paper rubles a day. Then what are you questioning me about? I was so young and foolish. I thought if they were prisoners, it meant they were criminals and deserved all that, you see? Well, you understand our attitude. I was not a party member, but nevertheless, I was a true child of my time. I was permeated with its spirit.
The central Kalama route stretches and meanders for 2,000 kilometers. All the route was built with hacks and spades, wheelbarrows and augers. Everybody here used to repeat Nekrasov's poem, The Iron Road. We overstrained ourselves, heat or cold, backs always bent down, lived in mud huts, struggled with hunger, cold and wet, and suffered from scurvy. Well, don't be afraid for the motherland, buddy. The Russian people have endured enough. They will endure this iron road, as well as anything else our Lord would send.
Зоя Игнатьевна Сизова.
So my father organized an underground revolutionary group in Kamchatka. But then somebody betrayed this group, and he was arrested. When he was being taken away, he said, "You must know, I am not guilty of anything."
Vigan Mikhail Yevseyevich, born in 1915, Kalama camp's prisoner from 1937, sentenced on the 58th clause, rehabilitated.
And I said to the officers who accompany me, "What is going on? Why, it seems even the slaves were treated better in the Roman Empire."
Lisniak Boris Nikolaevich, born in 1917, prisoner of the Kalama camp since 1938, sentenced on the 58th clause, rehabilitated.
On the 5th of November, 1937, at 5 o'clock in the morning, they knocked and showed me an order for search and arrest. And I was driven away by the automobile like a respectable man.
Zhona Georgi Stepanovich.
I was born in 1915, he in 1913, my older brother. When Kirov was murdered and the whole university went to the parting ceremony, Boris said to the Komsomol organizer of his course, "Look, my boots are torn, so if I go, my feet will be frostbitten." In 1936, Boris was summoned to the big house. He perished in the Vorkuta land. Those are my memories of Boris. I spent more than a year in Kristi, almost 2 years in three Leningrad prisons, Shpalerka, Kristi, and in deportation camp, when we were transferred to Vladivostok.
Mm-hmm.
People were transported secretly. I remember it was raining, dirt all around. There were many intellectuals, scientists, surrounded by the convoy and dogs. We were taken aboard the train. When it started moving, there appeared from somewhere, though we had been thoroughly searched, sheets of paper, pencil stubs. And we began writing letters. So I wrote to my sister, "I'm a prisoner, but I am innocent. Don't believe anything. All of it is a lie, slander." Trains were moving in an endless stream like in war times.
I'll never forget this trip to the Колыма, to the Нагаево Bay, on board the ship Джурма. Several thousand people were fed salted herring, and there was no water at that time. The loading went on for more than 12 hours, and then the ship pushed off. They simply forgot to give us water. And there was an order to get barrels down into the hold, to take the barrels and pump fresh water in through those. But there were many common criminals among us, and they cut the hoses with knives and razors. They pressed their lips to the cut, and the water poured down their clothes, while others pressed against them like leeches. There was a terrible commotion, and they couldn't distribute the water. When the captain ordered the water pumped right into the hold, we were flooded up to our ankles. Everybody had enough water, and the result was dysentery. 700 to 800 prisoners remained forever in the Sea of Ochotsk, half the transferees.
And as soon as we disembarked, they divided us up and marched us to work. A wheelbarrow, a miner's hack, and a spade. There were 12-hour shifts, sometimes 14, 16 hours. It meant that a man could hardly survive a year. Hungry, cold, sleepless people worked for 12 hours trying to do an enormous day's work. And one's rations depended on his task. The main perk wasn't victuals, but a ration of bread. There was a saying, a big ration is a killer, not a small one. That is, those who wanted to get more worked themselves to death.
Mirtsonov Mikhail Prokofievich.
I was sentenced to 10 years of confinement and 5 years of disenfranchisement. I was found guilty of belonging to the wrong class. I was sent to mines, to Verkhny, to Gorky, where people died of exhaustion from incredibly hard labor. There was great discord in the Колыма camps. The professional criminals, they would slash a man to death on the spur of the moment.
Lukin Ivan Ivanovich, born 1906, lives in Колыма since 1933, engineer, civilian, and honorable citizen of Magadan.
Every night we were listening for knocking at doors. We lived in barracks. There were many rooms. And when you heard knocking at the door, it meant somebody was being taken.
The annihilation of party men on the part of other party men was one of the main principles of murder for the Stalinist times. And they, in their turn, were annihilated by the new third wave of murderers. Berzin was arrested in 1937, and he perished, having committed murders himself for Stalin.
Soviet propaganda of the time was used to affirm, enemies of people are being re-educated by labor behind barbed wire.
My father agitated for the Soviets. He used to say that we would live a much better life and would have everything. Then everybody voted for the Soviets. After the gold had been discovered, they needed cheap labor. Then the prisoners appeared here.
Father worked at the Northern Caucasian frontier at USSR Customs. Mother was a dentist. I was a student at the Moscow Medical Institute. And there was my sister, 13 years old. This was our family.
And on the 25th of November, they arrested my mother. Well, father was not arrested. He committed suicide. My sister was alone.
And in the middle, our mothers, all dressed in quilted jackets and heavy boots. They were coming towards us. And neither convoy nor dogs could hold us. We rushed to each other. It's impossible either to forget or to speak about what followed.
The professional criminals were made our commanders. Before the day began, the commanding trustees used to read out, according to the decision of Troika, the Court of Three, for sabotage and economical counter-revolution, the following prisoners are sentenced to be shot. The sentence was executed, and every day some 70 to 80 men were sentenced. We were taken to the barrack. The door was opened. There was a terrible stench. I found myself standing close to a nearby stool. We were all standing so close that if a man died, he remained standing. There was no place to fall down.
There was one investigator, Radchenko. He used to aim with his boot at my belly and below. But nevertheless, I signed nothing.
Still, I got an additional sentence. For the economic sabotage manifested in breaking a wheelbarrow, 10 years.
In a solitary cell, in the corner, near the ceiling, they hung a tin pail with a very small hole. They filled it with water, tied her hands, and she had to stand in the corner with drops of water falling on her head. And then we were herded to a bus. Oh, it's hard for me.
Savoyeva Nina Vladimirovna, born in 1916, has been on Kolyma since 1940. A doctor voluntarily enlisted.
They found a letter to Stalin in his pocket. It said, I can't live anymore after what I saw. I know him to be the most honest man. It was a misunderstanding. Save him, help him. I leave this life, for I cannot guard my own father.
Vasilyeva Ludmila Nikitishna. Born in 1918, was on Kolyma from 1938 to 1952.
It was unbearable. They made us, the women, wash the gold. Once we were given cigarettes and sent into the mines. Suddenly I saw the people, like skeletons. They would move, fall, rise and fall again. There was a rule that if somebody carted so many wheelbarrows, they would receive a cigarette.
12 months a year, it's winter. The rest of the time, it's summer. By November, it was already 40 degrees below zero. There was a rule, work was to be canceled if the temperature was lower than 50 below. But none of the inmates ever saw a thermometer. It was the authorities outside the barbed wire who decided what the temperature was. So he didn't really beat me. Simply held my legs against the burning stove.
It's the commander.
He took me with him through Kolyma from camp to camp. I knew this man to be a fanatic. He never spared himself. He sacrificed himself for the sake of the gold extraction plan. He always said that one day of the war's expenses could be paid for by one working day in Kolyma. It was the war. Tin minerals were being extracted from Kolyma for the country's war industry. The extent of the war effort in Kolyma was creating good living conditions for the guards instead of preparing barracks for the frost or providing the camp with provisions and warm clothes. He needed strong manpower there to fulfill the plan and to give the state the additional kilos of gold.
I had already become a skeleton. My body was covered with scurvy ulcers and every movement caused me pain.
Kovalov Vasily Ivanovich, born in 1930, a Kolyma inmate condemned under Article 58.
They arrested me on the 26th of October. They wouldn't bring an accusation against me until December. In the meantime, they beat me every day.
Popova Lubov Alexandrovna, born in the Kolyma camp in 1941.
If the Germans captured a city somewhere, the atmosphere became gloomy. If Soviet troops beat the enemy, we had a celebration and we were even given food.
My father was sent to prison. When my mother visited him in the prison, she was told to gather a certain amount of money and then her husband would be set free. And she brought it to the prison. They told her, your husband has been shot.
The front needed soldiers and no new convicts entered the camp. Those there had to work hard. Besides, there was a shortage of medics. They were glad to find anybody with even a little knowledge of medicine. And I had been a student at the medical institute.
Tetsura Nikolai Semenovich, born in 1909, a Kolyma inmate, condemned in Article 58, rehabilitated.
That there were people in the camps who could keep true human features, despite all of the horrors, hunger, cold, and blows. And those were the sextants and the priests.
And two priests were thrown into the cell. The Khans raped both of them. One was 30, the other was 45. He was gray-haired. I protested against it, but they told me, offender, sir, it's not your business. And they raped them that way. I asked them, where is your God? Why didn't he shield you from this?
Zhigulin Anatoly Vladimirovich, born 1930, a Kolyma inmate condemned under Article 58, rehabilitated.
Should a small party of thieves get into a bitch camp, they were destined to either die or turn bitch. I watched the following scene. Everyone was lined up. The chief was sitting in a chair under a pole. Attached to the pole was a rail used to signal the guards. Two guys holding knives brought out a young thief from the punishment cell and marched him along the formation. Then he was led to the pole and handed a small crowbar. He gave three knocks on the rail suspended from the pole. That was ritual. The bitch's chief then got up from the chair, solemnly unzipped his fly, and the hapless thief would kiss his penis. Then he was handed a dagger, thus turning him into a full-fledged bitch. Then he was supposed to kill some of his old mates. Then he ceased to be human. There was the entire formation standing. Mujiks, foilers, friars. Then there was him, keeping mum before them, with all feeling ashamed. I thought then, I'd rather die. There was an uprising against the common criminals. They were killed the same way as in the movies, only the common criminals.
Solovyov Sergei Dmitrovich, born in 1916, Kolyma inmate condemned under Article 58.
I was sentenced to 25 years of prison by a martial tribunal. When we Russians first got abroad, we came back totally different people. A tremendous lie was revealed, that all the peoples lived terribly, that they were tortured everywhere. This lie was meant for idiots alone. The Russians began to develop new ideas. Among the soldiers, there were decent, worthy, sensible people who were able to analyze our past and what we had then and what lay ahead.
Levedinsky Volya Vadimovich, born in 1930, a Kolyma inmate condemned under Article 58, rehabilitated.
Among us politicals was a former army commander. He was so timid he died from a cart creaking. We read about heroes like him in textbooks, but these same heroes allowed themselves to be humiliated and outraged by the Khans. This is not to mention the guards. Convicts fall into two categories: thieves and bitches. Thieves imply the dignified underworld, one that declines to serve camp supervisors. Our guilt was there, to be sure, gave us strength. Found guilty, we felt better than those taken without any guilt at all. A restricted area was being set up. White planks with pegs were being built around the workplace. A guard said to me, "Hey, 594. My number was E-594. I still keep it. My camp number. Cut down that little tree. It's blocking my view." I said, "But it's outside the zone." "You have my permission." Then our mate yelled, "Zhigulin, Raevsky, don't go. All team, lie down on the sleepers between the rails. Don't obey the escort's orders. He wants to kill you." My friends and I wanted to escape. They perished. And I found myself in the zone. It was impossible to flee from Kolyma. I was beaten, kicked by soldiers' boots. My ribs and teeth were broken. I understood that there was an underground organization in the camp. As for me, I had always dreamed about escape. This thought was always in my head. They explained to me they'd set the camp free. I gave my consent and joined them. We waited in the permafrost and darkness. They were looking for us for a long time. The mine didn't work for a month. They poisoned us with gas, but we had medications, food, knives, grenades, and guns. We tried to go outside, but there were soldiers everywhere and had to spend 24 hours hanging onto the overhead cable. The guards with dogs got into the mine. They failed to find us. We had no food to eat by that time. We went outside. We passed the watchtowers. The whole area was lit. If they saw us, I was to throw a grenade. Then we passed through the bushes and realized that it was freedom. Could you imagine? We never believed it was possible to escape, not only from the mine, but from the hands of the KGB.
That day was much awaited in Kolyma. The victory wasn't only happy news. It was the hope of forthcoming freedom for those who survived. They said, whoever wasn't in prison during the war didn't see the worst of it. People still had hope and faith. Ninka Elena Semyonovna, born 1926. A Kolyma inmate condemned under Article 58. Rehabilitated.
Suddenly, on January 17th, the door flung open, and in stepped three men, the stripes on the sides of their uniform trousers. I instantly realized these were office holders. My heart said, they've come to get me. At the pier, men were loaded into one hold, women into another. Female thieves were grouped together. They had razors and used them. Clothes were taken away, and gold teeth were knocked out with spoons. Suddenly there was a knock on the partition. A knock with an axe or a crowbar from the other side. The blows were getting stronger. An ellipse-shaped hole developed, and a mob of hooligans streamed in. They grabbed the women and drugged them onto the plank beds. They screamed, of course. The very sight of them and the onslaught were horrendous. We bunched by the gangway. A virgin, I was horrified. The guard fired some warning shots. The mob retreated. I descended into the next to last step. Women were being raped on all tiers of the plank beds. The whole scene was beyond description. Something totally incredible. The escort with a Tommy gun yelled, "I'll open fire." That was a lucky moment for me. I grabbed hold of his gun like this. He thought I was trying to wrest it from him. I simply held on to it. He stepped back, reflexively, and I instantly dashed onto the deck. Нагаева Бэй, our place of destination, at long last. How many days we sailed, I really don't know. Suddenly we saw fire trucks approaching the pier. The hatch was lifted and all were ordered out. But nobody rose. A massive rape was going on. The Колыма tram. Convicts wouldn't let the women free. To separate them from the rapists, a mighty fire pump was used. The lower beds were flooded down there. There was a card game on with people's lives as the stakes. The stabbed were tossed from the beds. Dead bodies and human wastes were seen floating around. Boat hooks were used to fish the bodies out. Tree felling was seen as penal work. We got up at 5 in the morning and hurried to run to the canteen for soup and bread. You would put on everything you had, cover your face with rags, leaving only small holes for the eyes. But still it didn't save you from the cold. The snowstorm was so strong that you couldn't see in it, as far as the back of the person in front of you. The horses only brought 1/3 of the required tools, as always. As the guards ordered picking up the implements, we, exerting every effort, would dash to the sledges laden with saws and axes so as to grab the first implement that comes your way. Failure to grab just any implement meant you weren't likely to pull through a day. I saw how a young woman's nose was sawn away. She choked with blood, but nobody paid attention to her. Besides, everything depended on the team leader. The daily quota was enormous, 14 cubic meters of felled timber. The team leader may register your output or not. If not, a punishment cell was in store for you. The felling site was 15 kilometers away from the camp. On the way back, they arrange their own hallelujahs in the twilight. Tired and hungry, we were ordered to lie in the snow. Some yelled, others prayed, still others cried bitterly. As for the convicts, they would start hooting and whistling and using foul language. To stop it, the escort would launch the dogs on them.
Then there were the bitches. They were the team leader's squealers. They would beat prisoners and extract job quotas. They would beat you with whatever was in their hands. They killed and were never punished.
Men with frontline and prison experience headed the fight against the convicts serving the camp superiors. They knew how to take risks and believed in force.
At times, political prisoners, especially ex-POWs, joined thieves in fighting the bitches. Like Nazis, Dezimia and Geisha tortured and executed people, thereby fulfilling their superior's will. Servicemen ganged up in secret and used axes and crowbars to disarm Geisha. Humans would be too much a word for those beasts. There was a special machine to cut square blocks. Geisha, was tied to a large block and was left to move slowly towards the rotating saws. He yelled, asking for mercy. He wanted to survive, to live, you see. But the saws cut him into pieces. Well, it was a severe punishment, but fair enough. The news of Stalin's death caught me at Batugichak camp. We worked and thought, has he already kicked the bucket? Guys in the zone said, not yet, but he will shortly. God be thanked. When he died, the mournful music was played and we all started embracing each other like on Easter. All without exception, regardless of nationality. The superiors didn't know what to do. They had no instructions in the event of Stalin's death. The zone donned red flags. But mournful ribbons were not to be seen. There were many immigrants from Harbin, from France, from Eastern Europe. They all raised Russian flags. The Lithuanians raised yellow, green, and red flags. The Ukrainians raised a yellow-black standard. People rejoiced, although the practices remained the same. The thaw in Kolyma went on and on.
Stalin's death was like a crack at the Gulag Foundation. The camps remained intact for quite a while. They were filled full all across the country. Some 2 million prisoners remained in the camps after amnesty, by official figures.
The convicts seemed more cheerful after Stalin's death. The power had developed a crack. All rose to their full stature, determined to state their case. The ball was set rolling after a convict was wounded one day. No one in the zone would show up for work. It was a mutiny against Soviet power. The machine was no longer that tough. Our attitude towards it altered dramatically. We demanded that we not be locked in for the night, and no more bars on the barracks windows. We demanded free letter writing and pay for work. A few hours later, a duty officer was brought in. We refused to go to the barrack and shouted, "Get out, pirates!" I was standing out front, but all those behind me voiced their support. Shooting began. First overhead, then lower and lower, which is something I'm used to. I looked behind, and no one was there. It was decided to create an organized force, so as to hit, not with fanned fingers, but with a clenched fist, and hard. A party was to be created. We banded together and formed the Democratic Party of Russia. And then they scattered us through different camps. It was like dropping a box of matches. Everywhere we went, unrest and disobedience flared up. A wave of uprisings rolled all across Kolyma. There were people there who had gone through many lands and faced death a thousand times. The Lord selected them for the future. They defied bullets and the threat of execution. Shooting at them during escape attempts was useless too. We managed to survive no matter what.
Sergei Dmitrievich Solovyov was set free only in 1979. He attempted many escapes and was given additional sentences, but made no compromise with the power. He's still waiting to be rehabilitated.
I flee any time, even with a couple days left on my sentence. My thirst for freedom was my moving force, my survival. I made flights from a truck, a train, the zone. I remember a joint getaway by four at Ustilim. They were shot down 15 minutes after they escaped. Significantly enough, all killed escapees lay for weeks in winter by the watchtower. I never stopped trying to escape. There were lots of flights, especially in 1953. Those weren't merely flights, but veritable uprisings. Weapons were seized in a bid to break away from the Union, but to flee from Colima was next to impossible. I would make an escape, first of all, that I might take a free breath. And every time I hoped against hope that this time I would be luckier than the last. Several times I attempted to put together a team of five or six in order to make sure they wouldn't eat each other. There were such cases during escapes. When attempting a getaway from the camp, there was a 99% chance you'd be shot down. When planning an escape, you'd always get food ready. Once there was a rainfall, and as a result, there was a big ditch. We had 3 minutes to decide whether to run or not. Without hesitation, we both jumped into the ditch. I found Serioja, and then we dashed into the taiga. We went out onto the road, and we were short of foodstuffs. I never killed, but I needed something to eat. We were spotted and we tried to flee, but pursuers with dogs overtook us. The dogs had gold teeth. They'd had gold teeth put in. They caught us after 3 days. There were three of us, and the guards fired point blank. I got three bullets in the back. Two of them were removed in 1973. The guards were so lazy, they carried us to the road post to be picked up later. Car drivers witnessed the shooting. The guards left us to go drinking. They were rewarded for killing escapees. Drivers came up to us. They noticed I was still showing signs of life. For 20 days, they took care of me, so I survived. I decided to write a complaint to the United Nations regarding our entire communist state. That was in the year 1955. So I wrote a statement of grievances from Vasily Kovalev, a builder of communism, a political prisoner, and eternal slave. It took me 3 months to write the letter listing my problems. I wrote about freedom at large and captivity. I was taken to the Correctional Labor Camps Board. I said there, "Why are you afraid of me? I'm a downright wreck, only skin and eyes left." He said, "You signed your own death verdict, and we're not going to shoot you. We're going to let you rot alive for this complaint." Well, this bastard, I guess, must be still alive somewhere now. I was sent to the strict regimen zone, stone sack. This meant death. So I heard the outside door open and a dog's breathing. I didn't think they would set it on me, but they let the dog through the doorway and the beast jumped on me. It was heavier than me. I kicked it in the neck. The dog fell down and became quiet. In came six men and started busting me against the wall. I realized I was done for. Having come to, I saw feet sticking out from the corner. They belonged to someone on the floor. The man was dead and frozen to the wall. I couldn't rise. My arms and legs were smashed. For a month, I had to eat like a dog. They were real beasts, worse than Gestapo men. They were the communist Red Gestapo.
Hatred for the Soviet communist regime was the only thing they couldn't wrest from me. They took my freedom and everything else except this hatred. I hated them with my eyes, my thoughts. I'll keep hating them even into the beyond.
To our brothers and sisters killed wantonly, now reposing in unmarked graves in the Chilicurima, may your memory live forever.
The documents of these times have been destroyed. The watchtowers sawn down, the barracks razed, the barbed wire rolled up and taken to some other place. Now flourishing on the camp's ruins is fireweed and neglect, the foe of archives and of human memory. Did we exist at all? I reply, we did. I have declared that through each inexorable moment. I declare it with full responsibility for this, our document.
Screenwriter, Kirill Nikolaev. Director, Mikhail Mikheyev. Cameraman, Andrei Andreev. Sound, Natalia Solomonik. Composer, Dmitry Pavlov. English text and translation by Anatoly Antohin and Gwendolyn Womack. Voiceover by Daniel Kleinfeld, Liz Hilliard, Sven Holmberg, Brett Levy, and Oleg Kulikovich.